sometimes before the moment of death, what is called the review has begun to be carried out. And the person sees their whole past life passing swiftly before the mind's eye, dislodged, as it were, from the brain and memory. The events are seen in perspective, causes and effects, motives and actions, nothing being hidden. A very important period. And we are warned that we should try to be very quiet during this time, lest our very natural grief, if it's a loved one, should send thought and emotional forces which might disturb the quiet experience of review. It's valuable because from it there is finally distilled the essence of, or fruits of, life's experiences, carried together with those during life into the ego as the fruits of the incarnation. The review ended, there is generally a period of mento-astral unconsciousness, not egoic, which is never unconscious. This may last from 24 to 36 hours or more, or less. Then there is a gradual awakening, a re-emergence of external awareness, and the conditions then observed depend upon a number of factors. Foremost, the character of the individual. There, as here, we see our world through the colored spectacles of our temperament and our character. The happy, sunny-natured, friendly person gradually emerges into a friendly world, happy, friendly world, full of light, vitality, friends. The gloomy, self-centered hypochondriac to a gloomy, lonely world, until the condition itself may cause them to spur them to break the shell of self-centered thought and become conscious of their surroundings. The degree of evolution also influences, in answer to your question, the conditions. The highly evolved, or reasonably highly evolved person, is soon fully in charge, fully aware of what has happened, and capable of dealing with the situation of relatively permanent residence in the superphysical world. The less evolved, and particularly the disturbed person, may have trouble. Or run into trouble. Karma works. And we reap what we have sown there as here. Sensualists, for example, find that their desires can no longer be gratified. may suffer a peculiar kind of hell of their own. Of their own making, like all hells and all heavens. In terms of theosophical thought, another factor may be considered. Remember, please, these are all my personal views, won't you, without the slightest authority, though I have had the opportunity to study this direct and tried within my limits to accept it. This other factor is not new to you, probably, but the world to which our eyes will open at this stage, which I'm describing, will be no strange land. Why not? Because we go there every night with varying degrees of self-consciousness, according to our evolution, and how much we have of mystical awareness. Every time the body falls asleep, we are conscious in our mental astral body. And there, consciousness depends upon the factors to which I have referred. Karma coming in. Sometimes, however, peculiar circumstances will affect the whole situation. And perhaps if you'll allow me, I might rather break a study rule and share one or two experiences at this point and in this matter. In the year 1925, with my former wife, I was invited to spend a month at an old castle in Germany, at Rothenburg. Some of you may know it, Toppler Schloss. It's an old castle outside the walls. My friends, our host and hostess and their son were living there for two or three days waiting us. And we were met by the news that the whole castle was badly haunted and that they couldn't sleep. At nights there were noises, feet, footsteps on the stairs, pattings on the pillows, which were quite audible and tangible, so they said. Of course, we had arrived by air and weren't ready for this kind of revelation at all, but would I try and prevent the cure of this? I found a case to which I've just referred, where events since death had affected the consciousness of the deceased, still in their mental astral bodies. And it was this. This castle had been in the possession of a family for several generations and was greatly prized, as was the whole estate. But the German mark, as you know, had fallen to such a level after the First World War that it was nearly valueless, and many of these rich, hitherto rich families just had to let or rent or get rid of their homes. Well, in this case, the decision had been taken by one remaining member, Miss Emma, who to let. And our American host and hostess had leased the castle for a month or so. This offended deeply some few of the members of the family who were proud of and peculiarly sensitive about whom should live in their home, take charge of their ancient family feudal estate, particularly Americans, as you can imagine. And so they, in their half blindly and half driven by this family pride and an outrage, decided that they would get rid of these intruders. And so they foolishly started these disturbances. And after a few nights, it became possible to persuade them to cease. They wouldn't listen to reason at first, and some force and aid from a certain order of the angelic hosts had to be invoked. By the by, this is all recorded in a book. The biography of the hostess, the book called Vanya. So I introduce this not in the least to talk about myself, but just to illustrate for you, since we are a kind of family group together, a little more intimately, this answer to this subject than you would get in a book. One very curious example of this came to my notice in the city of Durban, in Natal, in South Africa. Soon after my arrival, I learned from the lodge that the lodge had received a request that it should send somebody to clear a haunting in a house. The attitude was that when you had something wrong with the drains, you sent for a plumber. And if the windows broke, you sent for a glazier. So, if you had a horn, you sent to the Theosophical Society. Innocently, I arrived in the middle of this discussion. And so, I said, take me to the house and let me have a quiet look by myself. Never mind about the people. And I found there the same thing. That a relative, a male relative, had died quite recently. Resumed mento-astral awareness after death, and found that all his family thought he did committed suicide, which he had not. And he was indignant about this. And you know, when after death people become strongly moved in these and other ways, they lose a little of their reasoning powers and their self-possession. They're really not normal. And they become, if nothing's done to help them, they become what is called earthbound. And this can go on a long time, years and years, which is so that instead of completing the return journey into causal consciousness as they should, they become, as it were, fixed in their obsession, you see, at the mento-astral level somewhere. By the by, this is one of the pieces of ministration that are open during our sleep. Help these creatures. So I had a talk with this man, and I said, I expressed my apologies, but I said, this can't go on anyway. It must please stop or it'll be stopped. So, but I agreed to approach the family and assure them that it was not a suicide and that the best thing they could do was to find out and to disabuse their minds and stop making erroneous accusations, which this gentleman resented and felt very deeply, apparently. Well, this came about. The family made investigations and themselves, with medical aid, came to the conclusion that he died a natural, if sudden, death. Heart failure, I believe. There's a sequel to this story. They were so pleased that the haunting stopped. The servants wouldn't stay, you see. They were frightened. And so they wrote to the Theosophical Lodge in Durban and said, please send in your bill. The haunting has been cleared. The work has been done. Please send us your account. L'addition. So, of course, they came to me and I said, I can't possibly take anything. Never take a penny of money for any kind of spiritual or occult work under any consideration whatever. I said so. So they had to tell them. So that other people said, well, isn't there something we can do? And so the lodge pressed and pressed. And so they said, there must be something you want. Well, of course, we're travelers, and we needed a traveler's bag. A bag, new traveling bag. So I modified. I hope I didn't break any occult rules. But it was such a pressure. They were nice, and I didn't like to be ungracious, you know. So I said, we value a suit, nice suitcase, a suitcase, which we got, and which we named. We called it the ghost bag. And Sandra there, who's smiling, she'll tell you, we still have it. And it's called the ghost bag.
No longer in action, it's used as a store place.
Well, that was a long time ago. Well, this kind of thing happens fairly frequently, and I now introduce it just to let you know that there is this additional factor. There's the state of evolution, and there is the degree of development and self-awakening. Some people are asleep, you know, mentally as well as physically, and others are awakening, others very much awake, and those who go in for meditation or deeply spiritual life, they're very much awake after death. The aged don't stay very long on the astral plane, cast off the astral body, and soon return into what is called Devachan. And the young who die in the full flush of passion, they must spend some time before their astral body is in its turn laid aside to become a disintegrating shell. True, and other factors. But this is one that, whatever may happen after death or just before, the condition of mind and heart before and after death can affect the, what you call the living conditions. Next, is not really the life on the physical plane a purgatory for a great part of people, and the life after death in reality a paradise? Not necessarily at all. The life here can be a veritable purgatory. Hell, yes. True. But so also can the life after death. Particularly those who die in the grip of a vice. They suffer terribly, terribly. Drink alcohol, for example, with the astral body all aflame for years, maybe, and they're addicts to alcohol. And when they die, of course, the craving is felt more strongly because there's no heavy nervous system and body to dull it down. And they're in the realm of karma, K-A-M-A, desire. Using the matter called karma, desire. And so they experience the craving in a very highly intensified degree with no possibility of its gratification. That's hell. That's hell. It burns itself out. Unless one can get to them and flood them with cooling, soothing, healing help. Personally, I use colors for that. And in this case, blue, sapphire blue. Flood, fill, and hold them. And the same with the other vices. They enter a veritable hell until the passionate desire has burnt itself out. So in that case, there. But eventually it does burn itself out, and a heavenly-like condition is entered in both the mental and the causal levels. I haven't time for that now. Ask me again if you want to. But relatively and very broadly, I might go with your idea. As many philosophers, real philosophers, have done. So the astral plane, the lower levels, can be purgatory, and the mental and causal planes, heaven indeed, complete heaven. The moment the astral body is thrown off and the person's consciousness is focused in the mental plane, they are at peace. They're at peace. Why? Because they can't desire. They've no vehicle for desire. Verbum sapientium. They're in bliss because they've no vehicle of desire. They can't want. They can't crave. They haven't anything to do it with. See? Therefore, paradise, as you call it, devachan in Sanskrit, then begins and deepens and deepens. And all the highest aspirations and longings and fulfillments then come to their flower in the most marvelously satisfying and complete experience. Not only the achievements, but that which one has longed to do, you know, but life hasn't permitted it. There we do it. There we do it. And this is heaven. And this goes on until the great rhythm and the sort of hour strike, and again the procedure of reincarnation begins. What are our possibilities in the astral world? I answer, depends upon the development, the level of consciousness, and the mystical and occult attainments. And my second part with you this evening will rather answer this question. For example, self-conscious activity on the astral plane and mental planes, I suppose I dare say are dependent upon, but I'd perhaps better say are associated with the activity of the force centers in the astral and mental body, the parts of the mechanism of consciousness through which the ego expresses itself, the degree of development. If the chakras are working well, then the person is fully conscious, fully active, in command of himself and his life, his vehicles and his work. If not, then very little consciousness, with all the degrees in between. Can we there distinguish, the questioner goes on, and thank you for the question, can we there distinguish, and in what manner, the astral body which is connected to a physical body from that which has lost his physical body? Yes, of course. The presence or absence of the connecting sutratma, or cord, thread of life. You must remember, as I think I've said, that the monad, whichever remains within the consciousness and life of the Logos, participates in the sweep of that life out into matter by projecting a ray of itself through the planes right down to the physical. And this ray is called the sutratma, the life thread, the life self, really, the life thread. And diagrammatically only, not actually, diagrammatically, the vehicles are threaded upon this, like pearls upon a necklace. Remember, all happens from within outwards, not from above. Monad there, ego there, thread down, and all the bodies in between. No, as far as I know. From within outwards. And they all occupy the same location, as far as their centers are concerned. Now, when a person is met who has no physical body, then there is no cord or thread connecting it with the sleeping physical body. But whilst we are still alive, when we are out of our bodies, this will sound strange to you, perhaps, though new students, those who haven't contacted it. I'm aware that I'm saying things well known and familiar to the older students. You must excuse me, I can't avoid it. But that silver cord of connection is not there, you see. It's not there. There's no connection with the body. But when we are out of our body during sleep, the ego in his mental and astral body has withdrawn. The physical with the etheric double asleep or anesthetized or fainted. The ego in the mental astral body is moving about in the astral world. You meet it. You can see at once that it is connected with the physical body. And as long as that connection is intact, there can always be an awakening. That's how you tell, friend.
It's
Well, as far as I know, what are the relations between the two worlds, physical and the astral? Why are they so difficult to establish? What can the reasons of these difficulties be? Oh, the degrees of density of matter. With our bodies, we can't feel the air. Why not? It's too high. We can't see it even. It's a gas. We can see solids. We can see liquids. And some gases, mists, where water and air are combined with sufficient density. But after that, we can't see. It's there, all right, but we know it's there, but we can't see it. Because the vibratory frequency
means that he's got guardian, but I take it not guardian so much as healing. Of course, I would need to go there and try, if remotely possible, to find this out. And I would prefer to do that, which I cannot, rather than speculate on the matter. As far as my limited experience goes, and of course remembering freedom of opinion about everything that anybody said in the TS, the members of the angelic hosts who come into contact with man do not necessarily attach themselves to one place, one person. The exception would be where a religious institution like a temple or a cathedral or church has been consecrated according to some valid ritual, and the aid of the angelic hosts has been included or implied in the ceremonial. In that case, it is possible that a certain angel may at least have established a vibrational attunement with that church, place, or place. Remember that the great angels, the great members of the angelic host, highly evolved, function from the Arupa planes, the formless levels, higher mental, buddhic, and atmic, where the question of physical location is almost without significance. It's all a matter of attunement. And they established their attunement with a piece of work on the physical plane. And whether they are actually there or not, visible, floating above, is of less significance than the fact they made themselves available. And when called upon, or when there is a work to be done, they will perform it. So if I might advise, try not to localize the higher angels too much. Now take a church, in order to be a little more precise, we will take a church. which has been correctly consecrated according to a valid, perhaps ancient, ritual of consecration, performed by a valid officiant. When the worshippers come and lift up their thoughts to the divine, a great stream of energy is generated, which penetrates deep into the inner planes, past the emotional and mental, where they mostly are generated, carried a little further because it's directed to God. This stream of energy is then taken charge of by a member of the angelic hosts and carried to the highest level, whence there is a great source of divine power. This is helpful because loss of thought and worship power by dissipation is avoided. Part of the function of this kind of angel is to conserve and direct energy. And this they are adepts. So they will take the whole worship, prayer, force of a service and keep it in a fairly conserved and unified condition and carry it, help it to reach the divine. There will always be a response. Earnest, sincere aspiration and adoration to a lofty being will always bring some kind of a response. And this response also is in terms of an energy, and inspiring, stimulating energy. Sometimes an actual force which can work on the physical plane, like a healing. In this also the angels greatly help. They conserve and direct the response in such a way as to cause it to produce the maximum effect. That's their work. That's how they work. Whether they're actually there or not is of less significance than that they are invoked and that their cooperation has been given. So the answer to your question, are they there permanently, apart from a direct investigation, in a hospital, I would say doubtful. Doubtful. They are in tune, you see. Like a radio or TV station. It's available, you see. Must they be summoned? That helps. Yes. They will operate without, but it is of help for human thought to summon them. Why is this? I suggest because man is capable of focused thinking. He can think of, say, healing power descending upon a certain place and person. That's focused thinking. Directed, focused, limited, directional thinking. Now the angelic hosts are more universalized in their consciousness. This is where the collaboration is so valuable. The angels do not readily concentrate upon a particular. They're universalized. their general. They're in touch with the great forces, and they know some of the laws and processes of the universe. Or of the kingdom with which they are concerned. Mineral, plant, animal, human. So, when man invokes angelic helps, he makes good, clear, concentrated thought of where the force is to be applied. Man focuses, angels direct. That's part of the value. So, it is helpful in answer to your next question if they're summoned. Yes. And excuse me mentioning my small contribution, but my book, The Brotherhood of Angels and of Men, contains a number of such invocations, how to call. I will repeat one at the end. Are they attached? Oh, do they form a group for that particular hospital or only for it? Not necessarily for that particular hospital. They might have a special attunement which would make it easily for them to function there, but they are universal beings. And it's natural for us, because we're men, women, the human kingdom, it's natural for us to think in directional, local terms. See, that's our forte. That's where we're valuable. That's how we can make that. See, we couldn't make it unless we could. Now, the angelic hosts, on the whole, they're conscious of the universal life force, universal divine power, universal divine intelligence. And they live very much more in a universalized condition. The two together, the universal force and power and light and man's directional thinking, make a very good combination. That's why I say yes, it's good for them to be invoked. Are they attached, in inverted commas, quotations, to a department, particular doctor, surgeon, or nurse? They may be not attached in the sense of stuck like that, but in tune and ready to use that department or person. But it doesn't mean that they have to be there all the time waiting for you for a call. No, not at all. I think, disabuse our minds of this idea. They're available when called upon, and they may accept particular affiliation or attunement with an institution or a person. Can an employee in the hospital administration have an influence on the activity of the angels in the hospital? Doesn't say what influence. Yes. I have come to the conclusion that effectiveness in this collaboration depends, amongst other things, upon regular invocation. It's the regular, habitual collaboration with them, calling upon them for such work as they can assist in. It's this regular association with them. So that every time you see a sick person who wants help, you will think of the healing grace coming upon them and of the appropriate healing angel being associated with them. And that becomes part of life. When it does, then it becomes very effective indeed. In that case, yes. Do the angels work for all patients without making a difference for only one? On the basis of karma. For all. But you are right to have put that last sentence on the basis of karma. This is the ruling decisive factor. Otherwise, for all, for all. There's no exclusiveness, whatever. Only karma can exclude. As far as I know. Many mistakes are made in a hospital, this person goes on. Wrong medicine. Medicines based on animals, etc. Are the angels conscious of those mistakes? Can they do anything about them? I don't know. About the first part, I'm not sure. I couldn't answer that question. I'd better not. But they can certainly do anything about it. And if they find someone for whom their help has been invoked is declining and the help's not reaching them, they will try and increase the help they are giving. Don't think of the angels as particularizing in the way we humans do. They don't. They don't. They're universal and general. Our value to them is that we particularize. And the two together make a splendid pair. Hence the whole idea of the brotherhood of angels and of men. There are always in hospitals many patients who are near death. Are there angels attached to the hospitals to help them? Yes, not attached to the hospitals. Don't attach angels to anything, will you? Attune them, not attach, in your minds, as students. Well, now you've entered another realm of thought and activity altogether. You remember I have mentioned, I think, that at conception, a member of the angelic hosts attaches the physical permanent atom of the reincarnating ego to that first twin cell. And throughout the procedure of gestation, building the bodies, mental, emotional, etheric and physical, and constructing the mechanism of consciousness, the chakras, and their perfect adjustment, right down to the glands concerned, the nerve centers concerned. All of this is assisted, nature is assisted by members of the angelic host, and at the right up to the moment of birth, so that you may think of angels being present throughout the whole gestatory period and at birth. Sometimes these angels will take a form visible, particularly to the mother, according to the mother's religious thinking, or according to the influence from higher levels. So I have met many and talked to many mothers, Christian mothers, who have affirmed that they were aware of the presence of Our Lady at the birth of their children. They saw a gracious, beautiful, Madonna-like figure. This may be Our Lady in propria persona, or a member of the angelic host, working under her influence, looking like her. But I remember also when I was in in Hong Kong, that I met a lady who had 13 children. I may mention her name now, the family is deceased. Lady Houghton. Strike this out from the record, but I'm telling you. I'm speaking to you about many things in this personal way, as I never normally do, introducing myself into it, hoping it will be helpful, make things real to you. And so I mentioned this lady's name in the sense that she was at a lecture of mine. Her husband was knighted by the British royalty for his services to the British Commonwealth of Nations. And she attended a lecture of mine on this very subject in Hong Kong 30 years ago. And, or more. And afterwards she asked to speak to me. And she came to me and she said, I know what you're saying is true because I would have died more than once in the birthing of certain of my children had I not received the aid to which you refer. So I said, was there a form? She said, yes. What form? Our Lady Kuan Yin. A whole revelation, you see. Now, in Chinese Buddhism, there is a saint, we would call, or a great being, who occupies somewhat the position of the mother of Jesus after ascension and assumption, you know, and the occupation of the office of, as it were, manifestation of the mother aspect of deity for the planet, if that is true, then the same wonderful personage will adopt the form most likely to be acceptable to them, and so making them receptive, the person of that particular religion. And so it's Our Lady Kuan Yin in the East. And I've since met others who have been conscious at birth of the help of an angelic being, Kuan Yin. In Hinduism, it is the Jagat Amba, the World Mother. And with us, those who believe in these things, it is our Blessed Lady Mary. I believe there's a reality in it all, very strongly. So now I've led all this up. Yes, I know we must go. I've led all this up to say that in the way in which there is angelic aid, I believe, during and up to birth, so I think there is another kind of aid at death and afterwards. And that there is an order of angels who assist the ego, mind, emotion aspect of the person to be liberated more easily from the body. More easily from the body. And so my answer is yes, I think so. There's angelic aid. You say at hospitals, yes, I think so. Everybody who dies is, in my opinion, in some measure the recipient of divine aid. And generally it takes the form of an angelic presence. Now there, if you'll excuse me, we'll continue on Friday next, though tomorrow we begin our other studies together. Thank you.
To try and answer some of your questions. They continue to arrive and prove to be extremely interesting and showing considerable knowledge of theosophy and desire for more information. The first one I have chosen for tonight is about the life after death. Describe to us, please, the real living conditions of man after his death. We will find this in our theosophical literature. I have contributed a small volume on the subject called Through the Gateway of Death, which may answer the questioner, but I may here briefly say that the conditions of living after death depend very greatly upon the state of mind of the person during the later years of their life, and particularly in the last week and hours before they die. These can modify what otherwise would be normal. First, remember that we are here dealing with the mortal personality of body, emotions, and concrete mind. This alone dies and disappears forever. But the immortal self, incarnate temporarily in those bodies, is eternal and never dies, relatively immortal and never dies. Supposing briefly we follow someone who dies a natural death through the experience, what is it like? I'm dealing now with natural death, normal death, perhaps from old age or disease. As the hour of dissolution approaches, the vital energies or pranas, which we have studied together, the five vital airs, begin to withdraw from the extremities of the body, legs, arms, and eventually to form a center, a glowing center in the region of the heart. After this, the body begins to become rather numb, sensation greatly diminished. As the moment of death approaches, this center of vital bodily energy is further withdrawn into the middle of the head, after which there is little or no sensation available throughout the body below the head. The person may still be conscious, or they may not be conscious. If they are in, for example, the coma, which sometimes precedes death, then they will be out of the body and visible to the investigator, floating just above it in the mento-astral vehicle. Connected to the body by the sutratma, or silver cord, as the Bible calls it. This generally is found to pass from the middle of the astral head to the middle of the physical head. And as long as this is intact, there can always be an awakening. Sometimes this occurs, and the person near death will awake. Sometimes there is a peculiar expression in their eyes. Sometimes they've been able to say that they are
conscious of superphysical phenomena, even beings. Eventually, however, the moment of death arrives. There is some evidence that this is relatively fixed. However, it occurs. The silver cord is seen to break between the first subplane of the etheric and the lowest subplane of the astral. After which, the body exhibits the true signs of death. The encephalograph will show no activity in the brain. The blood pressure will be down to naught. There will be no heartbeat or pulse, and probably no breath. These are the standard signs of death. Physical death. The body is dead. Its work is done. Remaining with it, however, is the etheric double, which interpenetrates it and extends about an eighth of an inch beyond the skin. These two disintegrate together. In the case of burial, very slowly. Good evening. And in the case of cremation, very quickly. Mento-astral personality has been passing through some strange experiences. Lord, we are considering death and the conditions after death.